Chapter 8. Thieves, Heretics, and Whores. If this story is to be something resembling my book of deeds, we must begin at the beginning, at the heart of who I truly am. To do this, you must remember that before I was anything else, I was one of the Edema Rue. Contrary to popular belief, not all traveling performers are of the Rue. My troupe was not some poor batch of mummers, japing at crossroads for pennies, singing for our suppers. We were court performers, Lord Greyfallow's men. Our arrival in most towns was more of an event than the midwinter pageantry and solenade games rolled together. There were usually at least 8 wagons in our troupe and well over 24 performers, actors and acrobats, musicians and hand magicians, jugglers and jesters, my family. My father was a better actor and musician than any you have ever seen. My mother had a natural gift for words. They were both beautiful, with dark hair and easy laughter. They were Rue down to their bones, and that, really, is all that needs to be said. Save perhaps that my mother was a noble before she was a trooper. She told me that my father had lured her away from a miserable, dreary hell with sweet music and sweeter words. I could only assume she meant Three Crossings, where we went to visit relatives when I was very young. Once. My parents were never really married, by which I mean they never bothered making their relationship official with any church. I'm not embarrassed by the fact. They considered themselves married and didn't see much point in announcing it to any government or God. I respect that. In truth, they seemed more content and faithful than many officially married couples I have seen since. Our patron was Baron Greyfallow, and his name opened many doors that would ordinarily be closed to the Edema Rue. In return, we wore his colors, green and gray, and added to his reputation wherever we went. Once a year we spent 2 span at his manor, entertaining him and his household. It was a happy childhood, growing up in the center of an endless fair. My father would read to me from the great monologues during the long wagon rides between towns. Reciting mostly from memory, his voice would roll down the road for a quarter mile. I remember reading along, coming in on the secondary parts. My father would encourage me to try particularly good sections myself, and I learned to love the feel of good words. My mother and I would make up songs together. Other times, my parents would act out romantic dialogues while I followed along in the books. They seemed like games at the time. Little did I know how cunningly I was being taught. I was a curious child, quick with questions and eager to learn. With acrobats and actors as my teachers, it is little wonder that I never grew to dread lessons as most children do. The roads were safer in those days, but cautious folk would still travel with our troop for safety's sake. They supplemented my education. I learned an eclectic smattering of Commonwealth law from a traveling barrister too drunk or too pompous to realize he was lecturing an 8-year-old. I learned woodcraft from a huntsman named Lackleth, who traveled with us for nearly a whole season. I learned the sordid inner workings of the royal court in Modeg from a courtesan. As my father used to say, "Call a jack, call a spade, but always call a whore a lady. Their lives are hard enough, and it never hurts to be polite." Hetera smelled vaguely of cinnamon, and at 9 years old I found her fascinating without exactly knowing why. She taught me I should never do anything in private that I didn't want talked about in public, and cautioned me not to talk in my sleep. And then there was Abinthy, my first real teacher. He taught me more than all the others set end to end. If not for him, I would never have become the man I am today. I ask that you not hold it against him. He meant well.
"You'll have to move along," the mayor said. "Camp outside town, and no one will bother you so long as you don't start any fights or wander off with anything that isn't yours."
He gave my father a significant look.
"Then be on your merry way tomorrow. No performances. They're more trouble than they're worth."
"We are licensed," my father said, pulling out a folded piece of parchment from the inner pocket of his jacket.
"Charged to perform, in fact."
The mayor shook his head and made no motion to look at our writ of patronage.
"It makes folks rowdy," he said firmly. "Last time there was an unholy row during the play. Too much drinking, too much excitement. Folks tore the doors off the public house and smashed up the tables. The hall belongs to the town, you see. The town bears the expense of the repairs."
By this time, our wagons were drawing attention. Trip was doing some juggling. Marion and his wife were putting on an impromptu string puppet show. I was watching my father from the back of our wagon.
"We certainly would not want to offend you or your patron," the mayor said. "However, the town can ill afford another evening such as that. As a gesture of goodwill, I'm willing to offer you a copper each, say 20 pennies, simply to be on your way and not make any trouble for us here."
Now, you have to understand that 20 pennies might be a good bit of money for some little ragamuffin troupe living hand to mouth, but for us, it was simply insulting. He should have offered us 40 to play for the evening, free use of the public hall, a good meal, and beds at the inn. The last we would graciously decline, as their beds were no doubt lousy and those in our wagons were not. If my father was surprised or insulted, he did not show it.
"Pack up!"
he shouted over one shoulder. Trip tucked his juggling stones into various pockets without so much as a flourish. There was a disappointed chorus from several dozen townsfolk as the puppets stopped mid-jape and were packed away. The mayor looked relieved, brought out his purse, and pulled out 2 silver pennies.
"I'll be sure to tell the Baron of your generosity,"
my father said carefully as the mayor laid the pennies into his hand. The mayor froze mid-motion.
"Baron?"
"Baron Greyfallow." My father paused, looking for some spark of recognition on the mayor's face.
"Lord of the Eastern Marshes, Hudumbran by Theron and the wide Cont Hills."
My father looked around at the horizon.
"We are still in the wide Cont Hills, aren't we?" "Well, yes," the mayor said. "But Squire Semlin..."
"Oh, we're in Semlin's fife," my father exclaimed, looking around as if now just getting his bearings.
"Thin gentleman, tidy little beard."
He brushed his chin with his fingers. The mayor nodded numbly.
"Charming fellow, lovely singing voice. Met him when we were entertaining the Baron last midwinter." "Of course,"
the mayor paused significantly.
"Might I see your writ?"
I watched as the mayor read it. It took him a little while, as my father had not bothered to mention the majority of the Baron's titles, such as the Viscount of Montrone and Lord of Trelliston. The upshot was this. It was true that Squire Semlin controlled this little town and all the land around it, but Semlin owed fealty directly to Greyfallow. In more concrete terms, Greyfallow was captain of the ship. Semlin scrubbed the planking and saluted him. The mayor refolded the parchment and handed it back to my father.
"I see."
That was all. I remember being stunned when the mayor didn't apologize or offer my father more money. My father paused as well, then continued.
"The city is your jurisdiction, sir, but we'll perform either way. It will either be here or just outside the city limits." "You can't use the public house," the mayor said firmly. "I won't have it wrecked again."
"We can play right here," my father pointed to the market square. "It will be enough space, and it keeps everyone right here in town." The mayor hesitated, though I could hardly believe it. We sometimes chose to play on the green because the local buildings weren't big enough. 2 of our wagons were built to become stages for just that eventuality. But in my whole 11 years of memory, I could barely count on both hands the times we'd been forced to play the green. We had never played outside the city limits. But we were spared that. The mayor nodded at last and gestured my father closer. I slipped out the back of the wagon and moved close enough to catch the end of what he said.
God-fearing folk around here. Nothing vulgar or heretical. We had a double handful of trouble with the last troop that came through here. Two fights, folks missing their laundry, and one of Branston's daughters got herself in a family way.
I was outraged. I waited for my father to show the mayor the sharp side of his tongue, to explain the difference between mere traveling performers and Edema Rue. We didn't steal. We would never let things get so out of control that a bunch of drunks ruined the hall where we were playing. But my father did nothing of the sort. He just nodded and walked back toward our wagon. He gestured and Tripp started juggling again. The puppets reemerged from their cases. As he came around the wagon, he saw me standing, half hidden, beside the horses.
"I'm guessing you heard the whole thing from the look on your face," he said with a wry grin. "Let it go, my boy. He gets full marks for honesty, if not for grace. He just says out loud what other folk keep in the quiet of their hearts. Why do you think I have everyone stay in pairs when we go about our business in bigger towns?"
I knew it for the truth. Still, it was a hard pill for a young boy to swallow.
20 pennies, I said scathingly. As if he were offering us charity.
That was the hardest part of growing up Edema Rue. We are strangers everywhere. Many folk view us as vagabonds and beggars, while others deem us little more than thieves, heretics, and whores. It's hard to be wrongfully accused, but it's worse when the people looking down on you are clods who have never read a book or traveled more than 20 miles from the place they were born. My father laughed and ruffed my hair.
"Just pity him, my boy. Tomorrow we'll be on our way, but he'll have to keep his own disagreeable company until the day he dies."
"He's an ignorant blatherskate," I said bitterly. He lay a firm hand on my shoulder, letting me know I'd said enough.
"This is what comes of getting too close to Etour, I suppose. Tomorrow, we'll head south. Greener pastures, kinder folk, prettier women."
He cupped an ear toward the wagon and nudged me with his elbow.
"I can hear everything you say," my mother called sweetly from inside.
My father grinned and winked at me.
"So what play are we going to do?" I asked my father. "Nothing vulgar, mind you. They're God-fearing folk in these parts."
He looked at me.
"What would you pick?"
I gave it a long moment's thought.
"I'd play something from the Brightfield cycle. The Forging of the Path or some such."
My father made a face.
"Not a very good play."
I shrugged. "They won't know the difference. Besides, it's chock full of Telu, so no one will complain about it being vulgar." I looked up at the sky. "I just hope it doesn't rain on us halfway through."
My father looked up at the clouds. "It will. Still, there are worse things than playing in the rain."
"Like playing in the rain and getting shimmed on the deal?" I asked.
The mayor hurried up to us, moving at a fast walk. There was a thin sheen of sweat on his forehead, and he was puffing a little bit, as if he'd been running.
"I talked it over with a few members of the council, and we decided that it would be quite all right for you to use the public house if you would care to."
My father's body language was perfect. It was perfectly clear he was offended, but far too polite to say anything.
"I certainly wouldn't want to put you out."
"No, no. No bother at all. I insist, in fact."
"Very well, if you insist."
The mayor smiled and hurried away.
"Well, that's a little better."
My father sighed.
"No need to tighten our belts yet."
"Halfpenny a head, that's right. Anyone without a head gets in free, thank you, sir."
Tripp was working the door, making sure everyone paid to see the play.
"Halfpenny a head, though, by the rosy glow in your lady's cheeks, I should be charging you for a head and a half, not that it's any of my business, mind you."
Tripp had the quickest tongue of anyone in the troupe, which made him the best man for the job of making sure no one tried to fast talk or bully their way inside. Wearing his green and gray jester's motley, Tripp could say just about anything and get away with it.
Hello, Mum, no charge for the little one, but if he starts to squawk, you'd best give him the tit quick or take him outside.
Trip carried on his unending patter.
That's right, halfpenny. Yes, sir, empty head still pays full price.
Though it was always fun to watch Trip work, most of my attention was on a wagon that had rolled into the other end of town about a quarter hour ago. The mayor had argued with the old man driving it, then stormed off. Now, I saw the mayor heading back to the wagon, accompanied by a tall fellow carrying a long cudgel, the constable, unless I missed my guess. My curiosity got the best of me, and I made my way toward the wagon, doing my best to stay out of sight. The mayor and the old man were arguing again by the time I got close enough to hear. The constable stood nearby, looking irritated and anxious.
Told you, I don't have a license. I don't need a license. Does a peddler need a license? Does a tinker need a license?
You're not a tinker,
the mayor said.
Don't try to pass yourself off as one.
I'm not trying to pass myself off as anything, the old man snapped. I'm a tinker and a peddler, and I'm more than both. I'm an arcanist, you great dithering heap of idiot.
My point exactly,
the mayor said doggedly.
We're God-fearing people in these parts. We don't want any meddling with dark things, better left alone. We don't want the trouble your kind can bring.
My kind, the old man said. What do you know about my kind? There probably hasn't been an arcanist through these parts in 50 years.
We like it that way. Just turn around and go back the way you came.
Like hell if I'm spending a night in the rain because of your thick head, the man said hotly. I don't need your permission to rent a room or to do business in the street. Now get away from me or I'll show you firsthand what sort of trouble my kind can be.
Fear flashed across the mayor's face before it was overwhelmed by outrage. He gestured over one shoulder at the constable.
Then you'll spend the night in jail for vagrancy and threatening behavior. We'll let you on your way in the morning if you've learned to keep a civil tongue in your head.
The constable advanced on the wagon, his cudgel held cautiously at his side. The old man stood his ground and raised one hand. A deep red light welled up from the front corners of his wagon.
That's far enough, he said ominously. Things could get ugly otherwise.
After a moment's surprise, I realized the strange light came from a pair of sympathy lamps the old man had mounted on his wagon. I had seen one before in Lord Greyfellow's library. They were brighter than gaslight, steadier than candles or lamps, and lasted nearly forever. They were also terribly expensive. I was willing to bet that no one in this little town had ever heard of them, let alone seen one. The constable stopped in his tracks when the light began to swell, but when nothing else seemed to happen, he set his jaw and kept walking toward the wagon. The old man's expression grew anxious.
Now hold on a moment,
he said as the red light from the wagon started to fade.
We don't want...
Shut your clepper, you old shitfire,
the constable said. He snatched at the arcanist's arm as if he were sticking his hand into an oven. Then, when nothing happened, he smiled and grew more confident.
Don't think I won't knock you a good one to keep you from working any more of your devilry.
Well done, Tom,
the mayor said, radiating relief.
Bring him along and we'll send someone back for the wagon.
The constable grinned and twisted the old man's arm. The arcanist bent at the waist and gasped a short, painful breath. From where I hid, I saw the arcanist's face change from anxious to pained to angry all in a second. I saw his mouth move. A furious gust of wind came out of nowhere, as if a storm had suddenly burst with no warning. The wind struck the old man's wagon and it tipped onto two wheels before slamming back down onto four. The constable staggered and fell as if he'd been struck by the hand of God. Even where I hid, nearly 30 feet away, the wind was so strong that I was forced to take a step forward, as if I'd been pushed roughly from behind.
Be gone!
The old man shouted angrily.
Trouble me no longer! I will set fire to your blood and fill you with a fear like ice and iron!
There was something familiar about his words, but I couldn't put my finger on it. Both the mayor and the constable turned tail and ran, their eyes white and wild as startled horses. The wind faded as quickly as it had come. The whole sudden burst couldn't have lasted more than 5 seconds. As most of the townsfolk were gathered around the public house, I doubted anyone had seen it except for me, the mayor, the constable, and the old man's donkeys who stood placidly in their harness, utterly unperturbed.
"Leave this place clean of your foul presence,"
the arcanist muttered to himself as he watched them go.
"By the power of my name, I command it to be so."
I finally realized why his words seemed so familiar. He was quoting lines from the exorcism scene of Deonica. Not many folk knew that play. The old man turned back to his wagon and began to extemporize.
"I'll turn you into butter on a summer day. I'll turn you into a poet with the soul of a priest. I'll fill you with lemon custard and push you out a window," he spat. "Bastards!"
His irritation seemed to leave him, and he heaved a great, weary sigh.
"Well, that couldn't have gone much worse," the old man muttered as he rubbed at the shoulder of the arm the constable had twisted. "Do you think they'll come back with a mob behind them?"
For a second, I thought the old man was talking to me. Then I realized the truth. He was talking to his donkeys.
"I don't think so either," he said to them. "But I've been wrong before. Let's stay near the edge of town and have a look at the last of the oats, shall we?"
He clambered up into the back of the wagon and came down with a wide bucket and a nearly empty burlap sack. He upended the sack into the bucket and seemed disheartened by the results. He took out a handful for himself before nudging the bucket toward the donkeys with his foot.
"Don't give me that look," he said to them. "It's short rations all around. Besides, you can graze."
He petted one donkey while he ate his handful of rough oats, stopping occasionally to spit out a husk. It struck me as very sad. This old man all alone on the road with no one to talk to but his donkeys. It's hard for us, Edema Rue, but at least we had each other. This man had no one.
"We've wandered too far from civilization, boys. The folk that need me don't trust me, and the ones that trust me can't afford me."
The old man peered into his purse.
"We've got a penny and a half, so our options are limited. Do we want to be wet tonight or hungry tomorrow? We're not going to do any business, so it will probably be one or the other."
I slunk around the edge of the building until I could see what was written on the side of the old man's wagon. It read, "Abinthy, Arcanist Extraordinary, Scribe, Dowser, Chemist, Dentist, Rare Goods, All Ailments Tended, Lost Items Found, Anything Mended, No Horoscopes, No Love Potions, No Malefaction." Abinthy noticed me as soon as I stepped out from behind the building where I'd been hiding.
"Hello there. Can I help you?"
"You've misspelled ailments," I pointed out.
He looked surprised.
"It's a joke, actually," he explained. "I brew a bit."
"Oh, ale,"
I said, nodding.
"I get it."
I brought my hand out of my pocket. "Can you sell me anything for a penny?" He seemed stuck between amusement and curiosity.
"What are you looking for?"
"I'd like some Lucilium."
We had performed Fairy in the Fair a dozen times in the last month, and it had filled my young mind with intrigue and assassination.
"Are you expecting someone to poison you?"
he said, somewhat taken aback.
"Not really, but it seems to me that if you wait around until you know you need an antidote, it's probably too late to pick one up."
"I suppose I could sell you a penny's worth," he said. "That would be about a dose for a person your size. But it's dangerous stuff in its own right. It only cures certain poisons. You can hurt yourself if you take it at the wrong time."
"Oh," I said. "I didn't know that."
In the play, it was touted as an infallible cure-all. Abinthy tapped his lips thoughtfully.
"Can you answer me a question in the meantime?"
I nodded.
"Whose troop is that?"
"In a way, it's mine," I said. But in another way, it's my father's, because he runs the show and points which way the wagons go. But it's Baron Greyfallow's, too, because he's our patron. We're Lord Greyfallow's men. The old man gave me an amused look.
I've heard of you. Good troop. Good reputation.
I nodded, not seeing any point in false modesty.
Do you think your father might be interested in taking on any help? He asked. I don't claim to be much of an actor, but I'm handy to have around. I could make you face paint and rouge that aren't all full of lead and mercury and arsenic. I can do lights, too, quick, clean, and bright. Different colors if you want them.
I didn't have to think too hard about it. Candles were expensive and vulnerable to drafts. Torches were dirty and dangerous, and everyone in the troupe learned the dangers of cosmetics at an early age. It was hard to become an old seasoned trooper when you painted poison on yourself every third day and ended up raving mad by the time you were 25. I may be overstepping myself a little, I said as I held out my hand for him to shake, but let me be the first to welcome you to the troop. If this is to be a full and honest account of my life and deeds, I feel I should mention that my reasons for inviting Ben into our troop were not entirely altruistic. It's true that quality cosmetics and clean lights were a welcome addition to our troop. It's also true that I'd felt sorry for the old man alone on the road. But underneath it all, I was moved by my curiosity. I had seen Abinthy do something I could not explain. Something strange and wonderful. Not his trick with the sympathy lamps. I recognized that for what it was. Showmanship. A bluff to impress ignorant townsfolk. What he had done afterward was different. He called the wind, and the wind came. It was magic. Real magic. The sort of magic I'd heard about in stories of Taberlin the Great. The sort of magic I hadn't believed in since I was 6. Now, I didn't know what to believe. So I invited him into our troop, hoping to find answers to my questions. Though I didn't know it at the time, I was looking for the name of the wind.